Today, I want to try as much as possible to finish up the kinetics chapter so that we can move on. But there are a couple of really important topics that we haven't gotten to yet. And I might as well tackle the one that's going to be the trickiest, which is the integrated rate laws. And the reason I'm talking about this first is because in lab this morning and afternoon, we were talking about the method of initial rates, which is the topic that we ended lecture with last week, one of the ways of determining the rate law for a reaction. So, method of initial rates depends on being able somehow to measure an instantaneous rate or something close enough to it. Because not to get into the details, it kind of works if it's not exactly instantaneous, as our lab will demonstrate. But there is this other way known as the integrated rate law, where if you're able to measure concentration carefully over time, you can examine the form of that graph, in other words, the graph of concentration versus time, in order to figure out how a reagent affects or doesn't affect the rate of reaction. So it's another way of coming up with the rate law. But it is called integrated rate laws because it involves integration, which is a calculus process. And I would like to go through the derivation badly, because as much as I used to love math, you get a bit rusty if you don't use it all the time. So please forgive my slightly imprecise use of symbols, but if you just get the point of what's going on here. And I know that not everybody's going to get the calculus, so at the end I'm going to tell you what do you have to know. But for those of you who can understand the in-between, that's why I would like to walk through this. So, and I can't believe I did it again. I forgot to look at my zero-order reaction example. So I will do that later so I can make sure by Friday to give it to you, because section two, the quiz, is going to be Monday, because everything's delayed by a day roughly, and so we need a little time to discuss still. So I will get you that example, real-life example of a zero-order reaction. But since we've talked about molecularity and order, let's talk about what that would look like. So zero-order reaction. And what that means is that there's no concentrations. So the rate of the reaction is independent of any concentrations present in solution.
Is this supposed to be a fill in the blank, or?
The fact that there is nothing there is fact that the rate of the reaction is independent of any concentrations. So, nothing there. Okay. Now, what is our definition of rate? Change in concentration of something over time. And because the empty bracket just looks like a void, I'm going to put the letter X in there. So some reagent X, or actually better said, some product X, but we're going to get to that in just a bit. So that's the way that would look for us in terms of average rate. So now this is where the calculus happens. Suppose we wanted to... Oh, darn it. There we go. So, suppose we did want to slip into calculus mode, which means we change the D symbols that we put in front. And for those of you who haven't had calculus, the easiest way to say it is, it means right at that instant. And there's a whole math and painful way of dealing with these things to make them make sense. And that's what I'm about to do, because what if we wanted to integrate this? There's people in the waiting room. What if we wanted to integrate this? Those of you who have had calculus, what will we do?
Can you repeat it?
Yes, if we wanted to integrate this somehow, what would we need to do? And maybe that is beyond the level of the class. But what you'd need to do is separate out your variables. And then we would integrate. So we would say the integral from the concentration at time 0 to the concentration at time t of d concentration is equal to the integral of 0 to t of k dt. Correct, those of you who are math geeks? Remember, I used to be one, so I don't use the term disparagingly. Oh, I see the chat window's not open. Wow, I'm not with it. Yes, okay, thank you. All right, so what does that turn into? Well, you get, on the left-hand side, simply x evaluated from 0 to t. And then we, on the right-hand side, we get kt evaluated from 0 to t. So on the left-hand side, that turns into x at time t minus the initial concentration is equal simply to kt. So what does that mean? That the final concentration... Wait, I did something wrong here. Ah! Okay, what did Dr. Gray do wrong? And I guess this is the part of the conversation I shouldn't have... I should have had first. No, what I did wrong is this. Oh, I could just see my fellow faculty shaking their heads at me. This is a reagent. So if we're talking about the rate of change of concentration of a reagent, then we need to talk about there being a negative there. Because I think I started out talking about this as a product, but I'm thinking of the lab because I'm so involved in trying to get us caught up in lab that I'm not focusing enough, I guess, on this example. So let me back up again. Let's say that we have some reagent X. And it's not going to affect the rate of the reaction, and that's what we're working on the math here, because the change in the concentration is just a fixed constant, the rate constant. And now that I've adjusted my approach to say, okay, this is a reagent, not a product, then it's going to make all the rest of this make sense. Because if we throw the negative in everywhere, then we get something much more logical, which is that you start with a certain concentration, and it drops over time based on a linear expression. Now, let me redo that color, because for those of you who fell asleep during the calculus, this is the part you got to know. That concentration at a given time is equal to the initial concentration minus kT. But why does that matter? Well, because what is the graph going to look like in that case? If we plot concentration of X versus time, then what I just said is we should end up with some kind of straight line. Oops. So there's a linear relationship between concentration of X and time. Now, you might not get the point of this yet, because we've got to go through a couple more derivations, and then I'm going to wrap it all together and say, this is how this whole process works. So I apologize, I was on the wrong track at first thinking products. I would probably lose everybody if I tried to clarify all of that product reactant discussion now, so I'll just try to be careful as we go through the next couple of derivations. But why don't you take your screenshots, and let's move to the next derivation. And let's talk about what a first order reaction would look like. So what does first order mean? One molecule is involved in the rate limiting step. And so that means that our rate is going to be proportional to that particular reagent. So again, because I goofed at the beginning here, let me emphasize. This is the reagent that's in the rate limiting step. So now we do the same thing that we did before, slipping into calculus mode. That the change of concentration of x versus time is going to be related to k, concentration itself. Again, we'll separate the variables. So this is interesting. We get dx over x equals k dt, or to put it in a format that the calculus people would recognize better, 1 over x dx is equal to, he did it again. Man, y'all aren't calling me out either. Everybody must be asleep today. He's forgetting his negatives again, folks. Because he remembered to say it's a reagent, but that's why you put the negative sign here. This is all just my secret plan to make these mistakes to show you what not to do when we get to the exam, right? Well, except, of course, you're not going to be doing all this calculus. So, but now that I fixed the equation, we integrate. So between concentration of x at time t versus 0 of 1 over x dx is equal to integral of negative k dt. Is it Taylor series? Which is the one that tells us that the integral of 1 over x dx is actually the natural log of x evaluated from concentration at time 0 versus concentration of time t, which is going to be equal to negative kt evaluated from 0 to t. And that means it's going to be the natural log of concentration of x at time t minus the natural log of x at time 0 is going to be equal to negative kt. We'll forget the plus c part, okay? Let's just forget it. Not even go there. So natural log of concentration of time x is equal to the natural log of the original concentration minus kt. So what do we do with that information? Well, you know where we do the substitution thing where you say let y equal to? And so I'm going to do substitution of variables, just like we did in lab when we did the Clausius-Clapeyron expression. So in computer speak, let y equal the natural log at some time t. So what will happen is that we'll get a graph where if we put natural log of concentration versus time, it's also going to end up being linear. You might say, well, how is that any different than the first graph? Okay, well, look at the first graph. In the first graph, it was a relationship to concentration and time that was linear. But now it's a relationship between natural log of concentration and time. So that's what is linear in this case. Now, let me just fly through this last derivation and so I can get to the point. Screenshots. All right. So then, finally, second order. Reaction. And a second order reaction involving one reagent. So in other words, we're going to have a rate expression, R is equal to K times X squared. So that's going to confuse people, sorry, involving two molecules of one reagent. So, dx dt is equal to kx squared. Oops. Let your instructor see if he can do something, if technology will work. Oh, it's so beautiful. Okay. All right, separation of variables. We get dx, so really fast forward, 1 over x squared dx is equal, darn negative signs. Wow.
Someone's tell you in the chat, so.
I'm so glad my OChem students are not watching me. Oh, wait, you might end up my OChem student. That really is a different planet, though, OChem. Okay, equals negative k dt. All right, so integral, let me get sloppy. Integral of 1 over x squared dx is equal to integral of negative dt, which gives us negative 1 over x from t to 0 is equal to negative kt. T to zero. And of course, that means the negatives are going to cancel. So what do we get? Written back in, oh wait, did I? I forgot. Hold on. What did I do on the first page? Okay. Instructor. There we go. Because here's the point. For the first order equation, we get 1 over x at time t minus 1 over x at time 0 is equal to kt. So 1 over xt is equal to 1 over the initial concentration plus kt, which, again, we do a substitution of variables. Let y equal to 1 over the concentration, the inverse, in other words. So if you put that on a graph, where now it's 1 over concentration, versus time, then it's going to be a linear graph with a positive slope. And I'm sure those of you who don't like math are thinking, oh my God. So what's the point? Well, let me show you after you get that screenshot. And so let's compare. Yeah, that makes it kind of hard to see, doesn't it? All right, there we go. Here are our three possibilities. The reaction can be zero, first, or second order in a particular reagent. It can't be all three. It can only be one of these. So one of these will come out linear and the others won't. Any one reagent. Only has a single reaction order. If three graphs are prepared and they are concentration versus time, natural log of concentration versus time, and then 1 over concentration versus time. Only one graph will be linear. And that one that is, but confirms, you could say, the order of that reagent in that reaction. So you would have some initial set of concentrations, and you just let the reaction run. So that's the difference between method of initial rates and this integrated rate law. Not being a kineticist, but presumably, if everything went perfectly, you only have to run this once to get your results. Because once you get the concentrations over time, you simply plug it in and generate three different graphs. One of these will be linear. The other two will be some kind of curve. And you might say, well, why are they all linear here? Because I'm comparing the three possibilities of which one might end up linear. And whichever one ends up linear tells you what the order is. So let's say you do this whole process and you find out that... can I think on my feet fast enough? Hold on. Wait, do I have a graphing app that so I don't have to? Why use your brain when you can have a computer? Oh, wow. Okay. So, example, oh, wait. Oh, hold on, I did this backwards. Ah! Sorry, your instructor's trying to do integrals and such in his head. There we go. And then what would this last one be? Okay, so if I did my math in my head correctly, this is what a real life set of graphs would look like for x versus time, natural log of x versus time, and then 1 over x versus time. And as you can see, one of these is clearly linear and the others are not. So in this case, this reagent would be first order. And that's the whole point. Now, particularly because you've got open notes, if you need the equations, they're the ones that are in pink, which let me make this final one the only one that's pink here. So you've got the equations, which we will never use because we're never going to do an integrated rate law experiment. What matters is what makes these graphs linear. And that's the reason for trudging through all that math, to come up with what would be these integral functions. Because then we do the substitution variables trick in order to make the graphs linear. So those three graphs at the top, the fact they've got different y-axes, that is the whole point. And if you can identify which axis makes the graph linear, you've identified the order of the reagent. Now there's one other detail that's not always covered, but consider this. We're supposed to be monitoring the concentration of one reagent, but aren't all the reagents reacting if you have multiple reagents? So what do? You start out with a huge concentration of the other reagents, if possible, and a tiny concentration of the one you want to measure. Why? Because as the reaction happens, that tiny concentration's going to change really quickly in terms of percentage compared to the other concentrations that won't change hardly much at all. So that's why you can ignore the other reagents. You make a huge difference in concentrations. And so let me write that down, because that's an important factor, how you'd handle this whole process when there are multiple reagents. So in the integrated rate law method, if there are multiple reagents, the dependency on one reagent can be established by keeping the concentrations of the other reagents large in comparison. This will make any change in the other reagents' concentrations tiny, So any effect on reaction rate will only be due to the reagent being targeted. And so that's it for the method of initial rates. So now, unless anyone's got any questions, let's move on to the topic I probably should have done a long time ago, and I get now why some of the math is at the beginning of the chapters, because of exactly the oops that I made at the beginning of lecture today. And let me show you what I'm talking about. Suppose we have this reaction, 2A plus 3B makes C and 4D. So what could we do to express this rate of reaction? Well, as I was stumbling over earlier, it's important to point out that reactants are disappearing and products are appearing. Which means on the left-hand side, the rate would be expressed as something negative because the concentrations are getting smaller. But rate would be expressed as something positive if we're dealing with products because they're appearing. And that's where the negative sign came from that I forgot at the beginning of the lecture. Now, there's a little more complication than that. Suppose that we write the rate of the reaction equal to product C. And that might be convenient because there is no stoichiometry coefficient in front of it. Right? But what does that mean? Well, if C is appearing at a particular rate, then that's not as fast as the rate that D is appearing because there's a 4 in front of it. So it's only 1/4 the rate at which D is appearing. And so, yes, that's directly tied to the stoichiometry and the constant that's there. Now, I said that if we wanted to relate this to reactants, we need to use a negative sign. And there's also the stoichiometry. So this would be equal to negative 1/2, the concentration change of A over time, and would also equal negative 1/3, the concentration change of B over time. So just because I know that some of you are going to go back and listen again to make sure that I've said it correctly, if we're talking about those integrated rate laws, they're related to particular reagents. And so we have to start out talking about rate based on a reagent, which is why that negative sign is supposed to be there. What I just showed you here, though, is the additional wrinkle that stoichiometry needs to be taken into account if we're trying to relate different reaction rates together. Now, other than some of the more complex kinetics, that really is the end of the chapter. And as far as the quiz that's now on Monday, this would be the end of material from the chapter that's on the quiz. So in other words, I don't want to go into pre or post equilibrium or first or second step, which is rate limiting. We'll get to that after you've all had a chance to absorb all the rest of this kinetics. So, since the quiz has been moved to Monday, I will do the review of topics on Friday. But since we have some time left in class, that means we can try to move forward with class material, unless anybody has questions about anything that I've discussed today. Is there an invisible one? Yes, you could say it that way. I like that suggestion. Someone said, is there an invisible one that's in front of the C there? And so, yes, we'll make that the invisible one. And that means there's an invisible one that's 1 over 1. Which I don't think I have a highlight color. That's okay. Oh, of course I do. There we go. Okay, so if we have wrapped up kinetics, we're supposed to return curiously to Le Chatelier's principle. But we've already talked about Le Chatelier's principle because I got too excited about the equilibrium chapter. I just went ahead and did it. So now, let's see. The exam is done and over with. And I don't believe I put any acids and bases really much on the exam. Did I? Even though we've already talked about some of those topics in class, haven't we? And of course, there is this upcoming quiz on Monday where, oh, I don't know, definition of pH or what the different definitions of acids and bases are. Okay, so of course on your exam you had a calculate pH question, so you've already had the pH, but what are acids and bases? What are weak and strong acids and bases? Those are questions that we've gotten to already. But there's one topic I want to start today that is the one that really gets people. And that's because we'd spend a lot of time talking about acids, but what about bases? So remember, there's two different definitions of bases. One is something that dissociates to release hydroxide, but that is not the definition that we use generally. The most common definition the one that's assumed in much of your chapter is Bronsted-Lowry, which instead of using the terms, I'll say a base reacts with H+. So, an example of a base could be ammonia, which I'm writing in the lone pairs here to remind us of the fact that it does react with hydrogen. So, suppose that you had ammonia reacting with H+, then we could write that equilibrium in the following way. Then it goes back and forth between the neutral substance ammonia and then the ion ammonium. And remember that I-U-M ending is often used to indicate something that's negatively charged or positively charged. But there's no such thing as H plus all by itself in solution. There's got to be something else with it. And especially what would happen if we had just plain old water. Well, there is H plus in water, isn't there? Because there's always a fraction of molecules of water that have the energy to be able to dissociate. So another way of writing this reaction would be assume aqueous conditions. Which I presume is universally done through this chapter. And if you do, then that means the following can happen. We could write this as ammonia reacting with water in order to produce this same ammonium ion, but also hydroxide. Oops. Now, that means that we've taken a Brunsted-Lowry base and effectively made it an Arrhenius base because we put it in water. And we can write an equilibrium constant for this expression. So K would equal what? The products, which are, in this case, let me write it the normal way around. The reason I wrote H first is because I wrote the lone pair there, but it does look kind of odd, doesn't it? So NH4 positive times OH minus over, water won't be there, so it would just be the concentration of ammonia. And this would get the symbol B, KB, which makes this a base dissociation constant. And just like a Ka expression has a general form, a Kb expression has a general form as well. So we could say that Kb is equal to what? Well, the conjugate of B, which would be Hb plus times OH minus over B. Now, this is where things get fussy, though. This is the equation you'd use if the base is neutral. But what would you do if the base was something like hydroxide? Well, okay, so that would be odd in this expression. But let's say that we had something that was basic and it was an anion. Like if you have hydroxide, where there's also methoxide, which is where you have a carbon with hydrogens stuck to the oxygen instead of hydrogen. So it wouldn't be hydroxide, but it would behave a lot like it. So in that case, once you put a proton back on it, it would become neutral. So again, this is if the base is an anion. Now we're running a little low on time, and this is going to seem sloppy, and I will explain this again, but what if we took Ka expression and a Kb expression and multiplied them together? Well, Ka is Ha times A minus, no it's not. Try again. It is H plus times A minus over HA. So if we start out with HA, we make A minus, which is the, to use the buzzword, conjugate base. So if we started out with a negatively charged base, then we would write this expression for KB. Now, I'm going to write a sentence, and this is the part that's going to need lots of explanation later. If HA, HB, and AB are conjugates. Conjugates are molecules that differ by an H+. So water has the H+, hydroxide doesn't. HNO3, acetic acid, nitric acid has the hydrogen. Nitrate, NO3 minus, does not have it. So that relationship between those two substances, the one with the H and the one without it, they're conjugates. So in other words, if A and B are the same thing, we're just using different labels, that means that A minus and B minus cancel. The H8 and HB cancel, and we get H plus times OH minus, which is KW. And since this is so squeezed in at the end, I'm not going to write this sentence down, but this is where we're going to go Friday after we review for kinetics. It is the fact that an acid and its conjugate base have inversely proportional strength in water. So in other words, if you have an acid that loves to lose its proton, that means the base that gets formed once the proton comes off will not want that proton back. And similarly, if you have a weak acid that doesn't want to lose that proton, if you force that proton to come off, then the conjugate base you make as a result will be strong because it's going to want to take that proton back.